Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, a psychological profile of Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il is North Korea's leader, the son of the founder of the state, Kim Il-sung. He's called the Dear Leader, and by many accounts, he's not the most stable of human beings. No one knows the inner mind of Kim Jong-il better than Gerald M. Post, M.D. Dr. Post founded the CIA's Psychological Profile Unit. A psychiatrist, he then looked into the darkest secrets of the minds of people like Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, Slobodan Milosevic, and others. He's recently completed a profile of Kim Jong-il. My guest is Gerald M. Post, M.D. Dr. Post set up the CIA's unit that profiled the inner minds of foreign leaders, from Saddam Hussein to Slobodan Milosevic to Kim Jong-il. Welcome to the program. Tell us, Dr. Post, about this unique fellow, the Dear Leader.
The Dear Leader, whom I've profiled for my current base at George Washington University, is really quite fascinating, and I think one cannot understand him without understanding the complex relationship with his father in terms of the nation. We now have at least four leaders I can think of who succeeded their fathers as president or chief of state. King Abdullah of Jordan succeeded the really remarkable King Hussein. Bashar Assad of Syria succeeded the remarkable, the powerful Hafez Assad. I won't spend any time talking about President George W. Bush succeeding his father, George Bush. But they pale to significance. It's one thing succeeding an important political figure. It's quite another thing succeeding someone of godlike stature.
Mm.
Being the son of God is a very dangerous role, as political and religious history teaches us.
And, of course, the founder of North Korea was regarded and instructed his people to essentially treat him as God.
Well, and in fact, the interesting aspect of that is the person responsible for the cult of personality surrounding Kim Il-sung was indeed his son, Kim Jong-il, the current Dear Leader, who was head of the Bureau of Propaganda and Agitation. So this myth of Kim Il-sung and the myth of continuity between Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il was created by Kim Jong-il.
I love the name of that department, the Department of Propaganda and Agitation. That's
right.
So Orwellian, it's just it's better than Orwell.
Now, just another observation. Of all the leaders I've ever profiled, the gap between myth and reality and translating what is reality here is really quite profound. On the website of North Korea, it refers to the birth of Kim Jong-il as being on the sacred mountain, Mount Baektu, from which in mythology all of Korea emerged. And what better place for this wonderful leader to have emerged from the two greatest parents who ever lived. In fact, he was born in a hovel in the Soviet Union under Soviet protection, a very unsuitable kind of origin. He has every grain of rice inspected, make sure there's no chip, and anyone that isn't perfect is thrown away. And most importantly, in terms of the discontinuity, Kim Jong-il was not a revolutionary fighter, was not a nation builder, was not an ideology creator, yet he has had to sustain that image.
Describe to listeners some of the really unique facts, the tiny size, the uplift hair, the shoe lifts, the Hennessy drinking.
I find quite fascinating to consider the large stature to which this man aspires, and the literally quite small stature. He's about 5'1 and a half, 5'2, wears 4-inch lifts in his shoes, has this pompadour. And it's something he obviously is very insecure about. When in his zeal to create a movie industry in North Korea, he took the direct route and took hostage South Korea's leading movie star, Madame Cho In-hui, and her husband, a producer, director, and kept them under house arrest for 8 years. His first comments to her, according to her later memoir, were, "Well, Madame Cho In-hui, you must be surprised to see that I resemble the droppings of a midget." Now, that's a fair amount of insecurity.
Yes.
He referred to, I think, is really particularly remarkable. The average income of the North Korean citizen is between $900 and $1,000 a year. Millions have died in famine. Just to look at the country, it's a dark country in terms of the power grid. Regularly, Kim Jong-il calls for sacrifice from his countrymen. At the same time, we know from the Hennessy Fine Spirits Company, an interesting source of intelligence, I might know, that in the decade between 1989 and 1999, his annual bill for their most expensive cognac, Paradis, was between $650,000 a year and $800,000 a year. He lives this remarkably hedonistic lifestyle in the oasis of Pyongyang while his country is starving. And, in fact, there's a great deal to suggest he has very little concern for the welfare of the North Korean worker. When his father once asked him, he reported this proudly, can we not reduce the military budget and give more to the people who are starving? He said he was sad to say to his father, no, father, I'm sorry, we cannot. We need to have this large army in order to protect our country from attack.
Compare Kim Jong-il to some of the other leaders that you've profiled.
Well, there are certain features in common, but of course each history, culture, and political setting differs. And so one of the features that I have seen in a number of dictatorial leaders in leader-dominant societies is the personality features of malignant narcissism, which is kind of a fulsome phrase.
What does that mean, yes?
Such extreme self-absorption and messianic grandiosity, that one, such extreme self-love that there's no real capacity to empathize for the pain and suffering of others, including one's own countrymen. Secondly, being paranoid, not paranoid crazy, but if something goes wrong, it must be somebody else's fault. Thirdly, having no constraint of conscience. What is good for me is good for the country. And fourthly, being willing to use whatever aggression is necessary to accomplish your goals. That's a very dangerous combination. This was the psychology of Saddam Hussein. This was the psychology of Adolf Hitler. It may be that a number of these features are present in someone claiming to be successor designate to Fidel Castro, namely Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, who recently at the United Nations spoke about the devil was here and I smell the sulfur the day after President Bush appeared before the United Nations.
You're in the process of doing a profile of Chavez now, correct?
I am, and I find him very interesting, and one of the characteristics in common for a number of these leaders, because underneath that surface grandiosity is a great deal of insecurity, and which leads them often to surround themselves with sycophants who will tell them what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. And that in itself can have really quite serious distorting effects. A leader needs to be able to have the best and the brightest, which was the way Kennedy approached setting up his cabinet, telling people, I want your best advice, I want you to disagree with me, when you feel I'm going off base, I need to hear from you. To the contrary, to criticize a Saddam Hussein or a Kim Jong-il is not only to lose your job, but maybe to lose your life. So that can give you a very distorted view of the world.
It's hard to imagine anyone with more of a combination of factors that could make them, here's a technical term, wacko. You know, you're the son of the founder of this country with this extraordinary cult of personality. You are, in the end, a complete dictator with total power. You're tiny, and therefore the Napoleonic complex can kick in. Is he the psychologically sickest of all the people you've profiled?
Well, let me take critique your wacko label to.
Please, I do not claim to be a psychiatrist.
That yes, there are some serious personality issues, But wacko in the sense of being psychotic, he isn't. And this is a very shrewd guy, in fact. And he's managed to utilize the nuclear threat to coerce and intimidate the West and China to helping support his bankrupt nation. You don't really have to be paranoid to feel endangered if you're sitting in his chair. After all, he was promoted to the axis of evil along with Saddam Hussein and the Iranian leadership. And look what happened to Saddam Hussein. There has been talk about replacing the regime. So there's every reason for him to be feeling threatened. What he doesn't understand is his own role in creating the very circumstances that lead to that that threat. But he, in fact, has been not intemperate in many of his acts. For example, there were times when the United States was quite preoccupied with our war in Iraq when there were moments of vulnerability that he could easily have gone over the border into South Korea. Didn't. He is rather attuned to what's going on in the world, although he magnifies his own stature at the embassies abroad. He has fairly well-trained intelligence officers who are reporting back to him about Korea's stature in the world and what they're hearing. And even though they may not criticize him, the very fact of reporting objectively what they are hearing in language he can hear does give him a view of where he is. He does seem to have a limited repertory of roles that he plays, and this having the courage, quotes around courage, to stand up to the world, he has managed to play into a virtue within his country, who, however, are really in a almost total information blackout and are really kept from understanding who he is and what he is about.
Yeah, no radio, no TV, and, of course, no internet.
Right.
Of all of the people you've studied, from Hitler to Osama bin Laden, Saddam, Hugo Chavez, Milosevic, who's been the most fun for you to take apart?
The most fun. Well, I would have to say Saddam Hussein, I think, because in large part because it was a really quite poor understanding of who he was and being able to contribute to a nuanced understanding of the man beneath the mask was a very challenging and an important opportunity.
What should the U.S. expect to come in the future with Kim Jong-il? How will he act and what's going to happen here?
Well, this is a very threatening situation. The question is, to what degree he can temper and move back into some sort of dialogue with the community of nations. I did an op-ed piece once for the Los Angeles Times, which could only have been printed there, called North Korea, the Movie, in which I was suggesting that he was strongly influenced, partially tongue-in-cheek, this piece, by the collection of 15,000 to 20,000 movies that he owns and seems to be playing out High Noon or Shootout in the OK Corral, but actually more appropriate in some ways would be The Mouse That Roared. The idea that you can, that the way to become wealthy is to, as Germany and Japan did after World War II, is to lose the conflict with the United States somehow, and is his brandishing of nuclear weapons designed to get us to support him. He's a remarkably interesting fellow, and yet he's in a bankrupt nation that is really going under in many ways. One thing I feel would be really quite important that may come out of what's occurring now, his countrymen literally don't know what he's about. How would they feel? How would they feel if they knew that while they are starving, and he is asking them for sacrifice about the luxurious circumstances he is living in the seven-story pleasure palace with his humongous bill for Hennessy cognac, with recruiting young maidens and junior high school level to form his joy brigades for his hardworking senior officials, the gap between man who's really bent on his own survival and the man who uses the rhetoric going back to his father is extreme. And I think they're going to make a significant case for finding ways of getting that information into his country.
Let's just assume that your former employers at the CIA might be thinking along those lines.
One hopes so.
Dr. Gerald Post, thanks so much for talking to us.
My great pleasure.